one of the main ingredients in comedy, is to observe and report. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I have always felt like the connection with the audience was more important than them thinking I was clever or brilliant or whatever. I would rather people go, oh, me too. What? Of course, that's exactly, you know, how I was. So I love when people identify. So really for me, just observing everyday life is the best way. And of course, then you just have to apply your, you know, if God gave you the weird brain, you stick the weird brain on real life and suddenly people are laughing. That's how I find it happens.
Hello and welcome to Life Off Screen. We have a lot of fun ahead of us today. Our guests are John and Anita Renfro. You may know Anita. She has a video she did. It's on stage. It's called Momisms. And it's everything a mom would typically say in a day to the William Tell Overture. She put it out in 2007. And, you know, YouTube just hit in, like, what, 2005. Mm-hmm. And immediately it went viral. Mm-hmm. That brought her to national attention. And it really caught the eye of Good Morning America. So the next few years, she served as a correspondent, the mom correspondent, mm-hmm. on Good Morning America. Of course, that led to appearances at the Grand Ole Opry, mm-hmm. Dr. Phil, Oprah, many, many different shows. So she packs out concerts all over the United States doing her own show, but also she is a staple of the Women of Faith Conference.
Yes, remarkable. And for over 20 years now, John has served as a pastor, and he has come alongside her as her road manager as well. So they balance this unique life. And what I love about it is that they've transitioned in a way that have birthed two books, and you'll love to hear this. These are a couple devotionals that are just remarkable. And anyway, you've got to stay on tune. John and Anita Renfro, married 39 years, living in Austin, Texas. They have three adult children and seven amazing grands.
Well, let's just jump right in. John and Anita, all the way from Texas.
Woo-hoo! Woo! Welcome!
Thank you.
Hey!
It is so good to see you guys. You know, we've talked in the last year or so, but I don't think we've seen each other.
We keep trying. You guys were like, come on, do our thing. And we're like, well, we don't live in the same state currently, which is a bummer.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah.
Part of our COVID experience.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I mean, this has really been a year of transition. You've been transitioning from Wichita to Austin. Mm-hmm. John, you went back to full-time pastoring. Anita, you shut down. No more concerts.
Why the people won't show up? I don't
know. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, so what's it been like for the Renfro household?
Well, we made a decision. We bought this land in Texas 15 years ago, knowing we would eventually move here, but we didn't know exactly when. So we kind of started the building project, and we got to, like, what would you say, John, 2/3 completion?
Yeah, a little past halfway. You know, we started 2019. We weren't in a hurry. 2020 comes. You know, we're going to work.
Oh, we're just going to pay it off as we go.
And have a good time. And then all of a sudden,
COVID hits.
You know, the old stuff happened.
And I would not recommend trying to build we call it the last. Jesus, I don't know what but the one that you're just going to stay in. We don't recommend it during a global pandemic, but that's what happened. And so then he had to stay in Wichita and work because I was not having any income or shows. But it also was interesting that I got to come and help finish the house while he stayed there. And, you know, the Lord was in it all. It's just hard to see it sometimes.
Because at the time, and that's true, you know, looking back, obviously you get a much better perspective. But when things fell apart, end of March, we were like, should we try to finish or should we just quit and wait? And we're like, well, the money, but we decided to make a run for it, literally. So we flew into Atlanta, got all of our stuff that was in storage, put it on an 18-wheeler, drove to Texas, put it in a barn. And then the end of May, Anita moved to Austin to help complete the house because she had a little free time on her hands.
Yeah. Suddenly, I
stayed so it could at least pay the rent and served. And it was crazy. And, you know, we were separated for like, I say that bad word, separated, but, you know, we were apart for like 6 months.
It was eight. I don't know how you were counting.
Anyway,
it was eight on my end. It might have only been six long. For him. But so
I enjoyed my ministry opportunity and made a commitment there, you know, to stay through. But if she hadn't come and been on site, you know, people were coming and going and we might still be waiting. But the good news, we got it done.
We're so rural now. We don't even know. I mean, this took us half a day to get this presentable
today. Yeah, I've been doing a remodel during COVID too. I added a porch. I don't know if you can see it, but it's about 10 pounds worth of porch. And those building materials were delicious.
Yeah. But you know what? Front porch is way better than back porch is all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
You got a good point on that.
Well, how has COVID confinement, I mean, how does that inform what you do? Because is it giving you some material?
I tell you what, there were a couple things, of course, so much material. All you have to do, I feel like, to be successful, I mean, this is not all you have to do, but it's one of the main ingredients in comedy, is to observe and report. Mm-hmm. And I have always felt like the connection with the audience was more important than them thinking I was clever or brilliant or whatever. I would rather people go, oh, me too. What? Of course, that's exactly, you know, how I was. So I love when people identify. So really for me, just observing everyday life is the best way. And of course, then you just have to apply your, you know, if God gave you the weird brain, you stick the weird brain on real life and suddenly people are laughing. That's how I find it happens. But
was it hard for you? Because let me go back when I quit Isaac Air Freight. You know, here 15 years of writing albums and performing, you know, 2-3 times a week for all those years. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I stop. And then I get a great idea, but I don't have an outlet for it.
Nowhere.
Like, so are you like that? Or like, are you like, you know, performing for your plants?
My plants love it. The weeds are growing like crazy. They apparently love my brand. I call it comedy constipated. It's like you're taking it all in, right? Life is still happening, but there's no outlet. So you're just feel very pregnant, you know, or constipated. Comedy-wise, and I remember the first time I got on the stage, I had one event in September. I hadn't had anything since February. And I had one in September, and I honestly didn't know when I got on stage if I was gonna like laugh, cry, or explode. Like I had so much comedy just, you know, stored up things that observations that I had made during COVID. So, you know, it was funny that first time it was very monkey mind. Like I was performing and everything coming out here was good and landing and I could feel the A's and the B's and we're riding the waves. But in my head, the chatter was immense. Just because I could feel the rest and I'm like, oh, wait, I know I have something funny that I say about that. What is that thing? I couldn't access it. Right.
Yeah.
And so then I was on stage again last month, a couple of times and none of that internal chatter was going on. So I was really happy that it had shut down with that one time. But the other thing I found, Dan, and you'll understand this too, because you have experienced both, like John and I have been in ministry life our entire marriage. So the first 20 years, my part was incredibly obscure. I was doing children's choir.
And it was not obscure.
Not obscure. John would.
Critical to my success.
It was. Correct. But I'm saying I was the church pianist. Just doing things, writing music for choral, you know, publishing companies, whatever. So very behind the scenes. And then, of course, it's now been almost 20 years on the stage, right?
Yeah.
So, actually, 1999 is when you did your first project.
That's so true. 20, that is exactly 20 years
Sorry. Ago. See, we can't
count either. We're doing math. Anyway, so 20 years of that. So there's 20 years before that, 20 years of that. And then when COVID hit the pause. I'm actually getting to the actual question that you asked me. When COVID hit the pause button on everything, I had people saying the same thing. Do you think you're going to be able to stand it? You know, just out there weeding and whacking on stuff and, you know. Mm-hmm. And what I found, which was such a delight and a surprise, is at, I'm 59 this year, I'm okay with my own company. Just mm-hmm. me and the Lord out there. I mean, I'm not saying that I prefer it to this day, but I'm okay with it. And I know, I think it was the obscurity prior that doesn't feel odd off the stage now, but
it's almost like a callback.
It is, right? It feels familiar, good. It gets a good response. No, but I do love the live experience. Yeah. There's something about people in a room and we're all on the same ride together, and I get to inspire and infuse the laughter. I still deeply love that, but you know what? It was a great comfort to know that I'm okay without it too.
Well, with that said, she's ready to get back out there.
I am kind of.
And now that she's had a couple of events and found out, oh, gee, I'm still funny.
You know, I know. I did worry.
You wonder if you lost it.
You never know. It's like, is today the day the spigot turns off? Like, I know that I know the mechanics of it, but does the inspiration and does the performance joy still exist?
Yeah.
And so you never know that until you're out there. Yeah.
I just think it's fascinating about your story is that it's kind of this duality you guys have really carved out. And I'd love to hear your story as far as what attracted to each other, because you're different, but at different times you really have complemented each other. And you are such voices of encouragement for the different seasons where God has, and you've done it together. Tell me a little bit about that. Going back to college, what attracted you to each other? Because you were in college in Mississippi, right?
Right. Well, there were some short gym shorts, as I recall.
Oh.
Well, on me, not her.
But yeah, we're going to start there, right, Anita?
No, we met in church. I mean,
that's where you go to find women, right?
No, church. Only if you're a Baptist. So
if you're going to be there 8 days a week, you might as well
find somebody who wants to be there too.
No, literally, they walked into church one day, lost. They were looking for another church. It got to be, you know, back then, the bewitching hour of 11 o'clock. So they just pulled into our church, came in, and I still tell her this. When I saw her, the bells went off for me. Now, it took her a while to come around to that. Fortunately, her mother liked me, and so she kept me hanging around until Anita finally gave in. But yeah, our relationship started in church. It's kind
of never left.
Revolved around, you know, church, not the building, obviously, but
the kingdom
and the ministry.
Then we got married while we were both finishing college. I also like building a house during pandemic. Wouldn't recommend that, but it worked out for us. So he was finishing seminary. We were on the church staff full time as a associate pastor, which means, you know, for those of you who don't know, that's the pastor who actually does all the work.
Yeah.
I was 28 years of our marriage full-time pastor, full-time staff pastor.
Yep. And dragging her around and the kids and her being actively involved in music ministry and creativity while finding her own, you know, being a mother to three crazy kids.
Right.
And
lots of material there.
Her own. Well,
who knew? Who knew that's what we were doing?
Right.
Material. We didn't know that. And I've got so much great stuff that I can't tell about people until certain people die, but still, it was relative obscurity though. I mean, even though I was doing things musically, which, by the way, in the faith culture I grew up in, music was very much celebrated. Comedy, not at all. So, because
I know that battle, Anita.
Right. I know. It was like, if you're laughing, you're having fun. If you're having fun, you're possibly sinning. So you should stop laughing. I'm kind of glad the Lord takes his time developing your worldview and your view of him and your view of how you can relate between him and the world, right? Mm-hmm. Because if I tried comedy at 20, it would have been a horrible failure because I didn't understand grace as well as I do now that I have kids.
I know. But at 20, she was a radio DJ. So I really was.
That was part of it. John was in seminary and I was working at a radio station in Jackson, Mississippi, and I did morning drive time. And honestly,
I never knew that.
The first time.
And you have to try to be funny.
You have to be funny on purpose, right?
Yes.
And the guy that was my partner on the morning show was also part station owner, co-owner of the station. So if he didn't show up, who am I going to complain to, right?
Right. Yeah.
Many days he did not show up, and I was left to my own devices to fill, you know, 3 hours of morning drive time. And I really feel like that was, you know, if you're talking about inflection or pivot point, that was the first time I had to be regularly funny, entertaining. I won't say funny, entertaining on purpose daily. So yes. I feel like that
brings me to my next question, because I met you in 2002, and I believe you were still working as the church secretary part-time.
I was definitely still doing church stuff.
Yeah, you weren't full-time comedy.
I wasn't. I was doing some events, right? I started doing women's events, like in church basements with poppy seed bread, because it was always in people's teeth, and low ceilings and bad lighting and, you know, stuff, right? Like a club, basically. I had worked my way up to, you know, more like regional conferences at that point, but I was having more work. And then
she was doing mostly music, you know, back when women's ministry first started, you had several ladies who would come in and share a testimony, and there wasn't a lot of humor, but there were a lot of,
there's a lot of depressing stories,
tragedy.
Yeah.
And so Anita, they'd get her to come do the music because she was so flat, you know, by like, boy, you can just play anything. You're off the cuff.
Let's be honest.
She would transition.
Time out. They were cheap. I could play the piano and sing. So I was
a twofer.
Oh, you're a twofer.
And she was a, you know, a minister's wife. So, you know, well, you have to pay.
Threefer.
Pretty close. Correct. So she would go in and try to, you know, let some of the air out of the balloon some of these times, you know, between the different speakers and doing things. And so it was interesting. And she'll tell you that they would call her and say, I want you to come do the music, but do some of that funny stuff. And then eventually, I think that's kind of the step that somebody finally one day just called and said, hey, we don't want you to do music.
We can get anybody to play the piano.
We want you to come do the funny stuff.
But we can't find somebody to be funny. Can you come and be funny?
Wow.
And so I was like, wait a minute. I mean, like, I was literally the last person to know it. I knew that I was funny inside my own head, but coming from the faith culture that I grew up in, that was not always appropriate to let out of your mouth. You know, right?
Now, how did you bridle that being a pastor's wife?
Well,
who said anything about bridling?
Okay.
Well,
she was all
said it to him.
Yeah.
I tried to keep it out of the workplace, but you know.
No, but I was saying
it leaks.
She's always been, if you will, the life of the party, and every church that we've been at, the staff, because we're fortunate enough to be on some larger church staffs, and so all the staff and the senior pastor's wife love Anita from the get-go, because, you know, she's just real and she's not intimidated.
Well, let me also
the senior
say,
pastors would have a little hesitancy because at first they didn't know how to take her. But I will say this, by the end of our time, they were like, John, you know, you got to go, but really, really sad to see Anita leave.
Oh, well, right. That's very generous. I would say that part of my spiritual gift, even before I knew that comedy was a career path for me, was to widen the acceptable goalposts.
Yes.
Like, because people be like, oh, well, you're pastor's wife, you need to be like this and this and this. And I'd be like, maybe I'm like this. And
yes.
And then everyone felt the freedom to be more normal. And I tried.
Right. Well, Anita, that's and the fact that we know you, we know that you are, you know, full disclosure, that's who you are. But I think that's also the secret of your success, because, you know, when you speak unfiltered, there's really two kinds of unfiltered or full disclosure. There's those who are very mean-spirited, and they use that unfiltered word as permission to just say whatever. It can be vulgar, it can be unfair, it can be mean, it can be hurtful. But then there's another side, which is is really real, authentic, honest, and truthful. And that's the kind of humor that people really connect to. Because when Peggy and I see a movie or a sitcom or a comedian such as you, what we love the most is when we can nudge each other and go, we've had that argument.
Oh, yeah.
That happened to us. You know? And that's really the secret sauce.
For the relatability. I feel like what you get when you come to a show that I'm a part of or a night of comedy that's mine is you get me the same me you would get at a Starbucks. It's just a little better organized. and maybe I took a little shot of B12 right before, right? Like,
yeah,
I never wanted to feel like you get something completely different on stage than off stage. It's just that it's a little more energetic. And I actually had a plan of what I was going to talk about before I started. John always calls them. He calls them the suggested set list because I never actually follow it all the way down.
Used to be my favorite thing with Isaac Everett when they went off script.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, where are we going?
So, right.
That's the fun part.
That's the only part. If people follow you from town to town, like Grateful Dead, you know, Deadheads or whatever.
Yeah.
The things that happen in that room that night are the juice.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Because, you know, we did 8 albums and people had them memorized. And if they came and we just said what's on the album, it's like, I could have stayed home and listened to the album.
Right.
But the fact that we would go off script and try to crack each other up and we'd ad-lib and our background was improv anyway, you know, that was the fun for the audience, but also for us.
I don't have that improv background, but I do feel the same way about trusting the room in the moment, like diving out into some response with the audience. And there's the occasional time that you'll get lost in the weeds with someone you shouldn't have talked to. But most 94% of the time, if you trust the room, I mean, and for performers that follow God, we trust that the God is in the room and that whatever's supposed to happen that night will happen, you know? And I love that part of it. So
I think that part of your radio time probably gave you some of those chops because you were reacting and you were pulling things out and you were testing and trying. So look at God's deposits. And even I think being a pastor's wife, learning how to do things well, good taste, but you can be real and not that finding out even yourself where those boundaries are.
Right.
And I love, you are so funny because you have this offbeat take on all things female.
Yeah. Well, you know, people say talk about what you know and the female experience the whole debate, are women fun? Men are funnier than women or whatever. It doesn't, to me, that's a nonsensical. We're having different life experiences. I just come at it from the female side. I don't know how to do guy humor because I'm not a guy. I couldn't be wholeheartedly myself and talk about something.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of a big breakthrough, even though you had been doing this, was momisms, this take on, you know, life of the day of a mom and all the things that she says. So the William Tell, is it William?
Yes. Well, okay, and Dan, I think you might have been there for the moment that this came to me. It was at a CCA, and I think it was in LA, and Justin Fennell got up on the stage on Vet Night and did a song about I Ate Everywhere, Man. Do you remember him doing I Ate?
I think so, yes.
All of the restaurants he listed, and he did
it. It was the Johnny Cash, I've Been Everywhere, Man.
I Ate Everywhere. And I thought, that is the most clever thing I've ever seen because he talks so fast. And I kind of filed that away. So about 6 months later, I was doing a DVD dedicated to mom material. So I wanted to do something about a day in the life of a mom and everything she says. And so I wrote down the phrases and I did morning to night, youngest to oldest, and I did as many as I could. So I tried to do to fly to the bumblebee.
That's hard.
That was a non-starter. So it was like, but what is that thing? What is that piece of public domain, by the way, music that really captures the mom thing? And it was the charge, you know, of Williams, right? Get the day, get going, get it done. So it took me a little bit to make it fit and rhyme, but really.
And that, of course, catapulted your career because it came out, was it 07?
That sounds about right.
And YouTube came out in 05. So YouTube's only 2 years old.
It was in its
infancy. It goes viral.
In the annals of tech journals, somewhere I'm an asterisk because it was the first video that women aged 30 to 50 shared virally. Up until that point, they had only shared chain letters and recipes, never a video.
What?
Interesting.
No, that's awesome.
I didn't know that.
It was a shock to me too, but it was in that age group, in that demographic, 30 to 50 or 30 to 45. Mm-hmm. It was the first viral video for females in that demographic. That was viral. So
but it not only launched your career really in a national level, but it also kind of established you as the voice of moms. And was the next thing, big thing that happened, Good Morning America?
Yes, that happened because a producer, one of Diane Sawyer's producer's sisters sent the video to the producer, and Diane Sawyer, even though she's not a mom, stepmom, thought it was hilarious. And so we got a call at 4:30 in the morning.
Wake up and you're like, oh no, it's the kids. This is Good Morning America.
Can we play your video this morning? I was like, can I think about it? Okay. That did not require prayer time. I was like, yes, right now, and I'll give you a release. Then they played it that day, got a great response on it. Then they invited me. That was on a Thursday or Friday. By Tuesday, I was on their set, sitting down with everybody and just chitter-chatting with them. Like, I felt like I'd fallen through the other side of the looking glass. Like,
yeah,
right.
I was in bed watching your show yesterday. How am I on today?
Yeah.
It was very bizarre.
And surreal.
Very surreal. And then I ended up doing some, over the course of a year, while Diane Sawyer was still there, I ended up doing bits for them periodically. Yeah.
Well, to flash forward a few years, it was such a joy for Peggy and me to have a front row seat when you were in the development and then you did the pilot of the sitcom.
Yeah,
because we'll never forget, we had been talking, the four of us, about as you were developing the sitcom and you were talking to different production companies to put it together. And then I will never forget the day you and John went around to like all the networks and you were pitching it and pitching it and pitching it. And at the end of the day, you met us at Downtown Disney.
So shell-shocked that whole day. It was amazing. And the fact that you guys were available, thank you so much, because it was so comforting to have people that had been there before in the Hollywood system, because we didn't know if what we were hearing was accurate or reasonable. And you guys said, oh, well, come meet us and we'll have coffee or whatever.
Gave us a chance to decompress and to discuss the activities of the day.
It was
it was a whirlwind.
We thank the Lord for that moment. It was quite a moment to even let us be there. And I believe you got a phone call while we were there as well. Yes.
So the Tannenbaums developed it. We were so richly blessed in every department. Robin Amy Hanney, he'd worked on Frasier and they'd worked on Roseanne, decided this would make compelling television, which is always a subjective thing.
And I should mention, it was kind of autobiographical. You played a pastor's wife.
Kind of a fish out of water pastor's wife. Exactly right.
Yeah.
And so we ended up doing it on like a spec for ABC and, you know, a rich talent pool. And I was completely out of my depth. And I will tell you this story because people in Hollywood will appreciate this. Having never taped before, we were trying to get the show up on its feet. The first day of rehearsals, there were three kids in the cast that had come up through the Disney system. Brilliant, great little actors, all had had, you know, 100 sitcoms under their belt, right? By that time. So the director, Jamie Widows, you know, he was doing 2.5 Men at the time and the Bill Engvall show. Everyone was overqualified except me, right? I'm the weak link and I'm number one on the call sheet. So
yeah, you're the lead.
So we get the scripts, we're on our marks, and Jamie Widows calls out, okay, Anita, we're going to need you to go. We're going to cross over, you know, to position 4. Then we need to look back, but look back at X. Then I'm going to need you to do your business, turn around and deliver the line at B, right over. And that was the moment all the color drained from my face because I had no idea. I didn't know the lingo. I didn't know what he was asking me to do. So I turned to one of the kids who've all gone separate, and I said, can you tell me what he just said? Like, interpret, like they were the human interpreter. Yeah. And they were like, ha ha, Miss Anita, ha ha, very funny. I was like, no,
I'm serious.
And they saw the deer in the headlight look in my eye. And from that moment, they took on interpreting for me. Like they would check in. Okay, did you get that? Did you understand it? The sweetest kids in the world. And they were like little angels that helped me get through it. But I mean, it's tough when the kids are like 9 and 12 and they know way more than you do.
No, I remember when you taped the pilot, I was there that night.
Yes,
and you know, we got back in your little dressing room ahead of time and we prayed and it was really enjoyable. It didn't get picked up, but in hindsight, what is kind of your takeaway from that whole experience?
Well, first of all, it was an amazing experience and grateful for that opportunity. Wish it would have had opportunity to see where it would go a lot, just because we had in that 6 weeks, however long it was, and making relationships and the people on the cast and the crew and everybody was amazing, and we'd have loved to be able to carry that forward, but it was a learning experience every day,
right? And we still don't exactly know, you know, when you look back, you're like, what was that for? Like, we don't know, but I can tell you there were so many moments we wanted to make our set a place of love and light. That was our mission when we came there. We're like, Jesus, help us to present your kingdom well. Not to be an apologist. God's kingdom needs no apology or no explaining or no translating. We just wanted to make sure that everything we did was with love and people could tell a difference in the experience there. And we had that happen so many times. John, especially when they found out he was the pastor, the real life pastor question. every day at craft services, he'd sit down and someone would sidle up to him and say, so you're a pastor. I've been dealing with this thing or that thing. And he was able to love and pray with people. And sometimes we wonder if that was the mission, that we were just there to be there for those people in that time. But I do know the Lord never wastes anything, according to the, you know, miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, you know, at the other miracle is that there were 12 baskets left over and that they were gathered up. And I believe that God gathers up the experiences of our life for his purposes. And to be honest, we got what I call a $1 million education, because that's what it takes to develop a pilot. And you were there too, Dan, for this. Every time we would get through the funnel, oh, they're writing a treatment. Oh, well, we're going to actually shop it. Oh, somebody wants to make it. Oh, like every time we'd be like, wait a minute. And I didn't allow myself to believe that it could really manifest until we got to the actual night that we shot it. I don't know why I was so hard to convince that it was real, but I feel like if I could go back and do it again, I would be so much more fearless. I realized that we were operating in a system that I didn't understand. You guys, of course, you understand so much about this. And I was a bit lost and insecure in it. And I'm like, whoa, you know, like we're just so different in the approach. And also kind of this, and this is not the writer's fault. I feel like I did not express strongly enough what I thought it needed, but it was almost a caricature of church rather than real people and real funny situations like I'd always experienced. And I don't expect people that don't know the culture to adequately, you know, write the culture. Yeah. So it wasn't like that, but it, I feel like if I could do it now, I think I'd be much more confident. And I love the opportunity, and I would love to work on something like that.
I think it's one of the things I love about you guys' story is all those deposits and how the Lord, you know, all those callbacks and how you're put in the deep end and caused you to be desperate in a way, but it's faith.
It is, for sure.
So, John, I'd love to ask you, when was the transition when you became full-time manager and stepped into that role, stepped out of pastoral? Now you're pastoring over the little wife of yours, right?
And, yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah.
I need a lot of adult supervision. Let me just put it out there.
Okay.
Well, it kind of, I'll say by accident, but yet again, knowing how God works, that she was doing a larger women's conference in Wichita, Kansas, and we had some family there. So I said, well, I'll go along with you that weekend and visit and just hang out. And at that time, Anita had someone who was traveling with her who did sound and product and whatnot. And we got to the event and we're hanging out and it's getting close to time, you know, setup should be happening, sound should be getting ready for sound check. And nobody showed up. So I'm like, okay, I'm here, you know, by default. I really don't have a clue, but, you know, I'll set your table up. I'll work the table with Elise and I'll go up and do the sound and make that happen. And so we did. We survived. It was a good weekend. And afterwards, we both kind of were hesitant to mention anything, but I felt I needed to be with her. She'd been out on the road and we tried to find three or four different people traveling with her and that was not working. And she would end up taking care of them as opposed to the other way around. We finally both kind of broached the subject. She's like, that was kind of nice to have you there. You know?
Okay. So let's be honest. I didn't want to ask him to stop what he was doing and he didn't know if I wanted him out with me. So we were both like, should we say something? But the Holy Spirit, you know, had been working on both of our hearts about it. It was such a relief when he finally said it. I was like, really? Yeah, it was.
So, you know, to the outsider, I would think they would think, you know, transitioning from being a pastor to being a road manager is a huge stretch. But knowing what a pastor does and knowing you, John, I see that as almost seamless because both cases you are tending to the flock. You know, exactly. One is a congregation. The other is it takes a small army to go on the road and take care of all the little minutiae. And you have that heart of really caring and making sure everybody's doing well. And I think it's a perfect fit for you.
Yeah, it totally was. And I'll tell you the other thing, and John would never say this because he's too modest, but a lot of the places we perform are churches. And for him to have been on both sides of an event and executing an event was priceless because he understands the mindset of volunteers and of people that are having to step in. And John would always come in and bring calm and confidence to the situation and encouragement. I mean, his heart is such an encourager.
Yes.
And even if the people weren't the best at what they brought to the table that night, they always loved him. You know, he was a great buffer between me because like, I just want things to go well. And if I knew he was in the back fighting for the night to go well, I could calm down and concentrate on what I needed to do. So it was such a gift to me, but then he was a gift to whoever he came in contact with because he's a lover.
I enjoyed the relationships and connecting with people. And so it was interesting as we went on the road that being a pastor, we went into a lot of these churches. We were able to, the pastors want to meet and talk with the pastor's wife and conversations. And we would find from time to time, they needed an outlet and they needed some encouragement.
And we were just there for trust. One night.
And so they knew we understood, but that we were safe because we're leaving the next day.
Yeah, that's right. We got no dog in the hunt, right?
We had the opportunity to encourage and minister that way as well.
Surprising, so yes.
Well, that brings up the point too. How have you found a cadence in working with each other? Because there has to be margins and time, you know, and you know, where do you turn it off? Home, work?
Oh, I got to tell you about our rule. We have a rule. When he was on the road with me.
Very simple.
It's a very simple rule. The 1 hour trying to get to the airport and the 1 hour before the show starts are not included in any material you can ever tell a counselor about your marriage.
Oh, that is great.
We're going to start doing that one.
We're the stress points.
We just exempt them. We do not adjudicate the success of our marriage based on the most stress of getting out the door and on the road and right before the show starts. Those things they're not normal to a marriage. And the fact, there's a lot of people that live and work together, but don't have that level of stress, performance stress, tech stress, whatever, and travel stress. So I can't remember who told us that that's a great way to.
That's a brilliant way.
We
need to implement that in ourselves because as you're saying, you know, like right before I go on to speak or do a sermon or a performance back in the old days, you know, that's when you're all tense.
Right.
Or like you referenced going to the airport, trying to get it all there and get on your flight on time. And that's where I would say we have the majority of our tension or, you know, maybe even a small fight.
He wants to be at the airport like an hour and a half early.
Oh, yeah.
We had to find this rhythm, too.
I'm early. She's like, leave 5 minutes
with John.
After we're supposed to.
So I'm with John.
The airport thing stresses me out. Then the show thing stressed her out. I'm back here. Oh, we got it done. And she's like,
No, you don't. You don't got it.
You need my monitor. Not enough volume in the room.
This is all so true. So what we said was, we'll just take everything that happens outside of those 2 hours in a day. And that will be considered our real marriage. And those other things don't count because they're not real. They're just temporary stressors. And
grace for those moments.
Well, we have that joy throughout my career and Peggy's. It's dovetailed so many times where we can work together. Mm-hmm. And that's really our greatest joy is, you know, sometimes we get a little giddy with each other. We go, we got to do this together. This is so fun. But speaking of joys, let's talk about grandkids. You guys have seven?
Seven and a half. She's in the third
two
trimester.
Thirds. Okay. Yeah.
Seven. Okay. You're going to beat us.
Almost
eight. You're going to pass us because we're at seven, but we're in a holding pattern. But okay. Why are grandkids so much better than kids?
Number one. Greatness skips a generation. Let's be honest. So we thought our kids would bomb diggity. But now that we have grandkids and we can compare, we're like, maybe they're just a little subpar. I don't know. The grandkids are so much better.
Yeah.
I think it's just at the point in your life when you are only buying kids tires for Christmas, when they're in their 20s and they need a new set of tires. And that's just, there's no toys anymore, right? It's just tires and tuition. It's things like that. Yeah. And you're starting to get jaded. Like, where's the wonder? Where's the joy?
That's right.
They bring you these beautiful grandbabies. You're like, there it is.
I am Peggy too. We absolutely love our kids. But I love them even more that they gave us grandkids.
Thank you. The way they show their love, to the grandkids is perfection.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I know the answer to me, but I want to ask you, who thinks you're funnier, your kids or your grandkids?
Well, see, my kids would answer that. I mean, people would ask them, Elise especially, is your mom this funny at home?
Oh, yeah. Right. Typical.
And she would always say, well, nobody's funny when they're grounding you, right?
So, right.
But that being said, people, you know, obviously would ask me, is she that funny at home? And I think she alluded to this earlier, that for the most part, literally talking about being real, what you see is what you get. Yeah. And laughter has always been a big part of our family. Even when she wasn't getting paid for it and sometimes getting in trouble for it.
Correct.
We laugh. We still do.
Laughter was a huge high value. And
same here.
Unless you had a laughter deprived childhood, you can't truly appreciate the freedom that laughter gives you. And so at our table, it was never a crime to laugh till you spit milk out your nose. That was always like, we finally
high praise.
We finally got to the point where somebody is really laughing legit. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but the other thing my kids would 2-1 tell you is that they think I'm funnier at home than I am on stage, because it's just happening in real time and it's, you know, it's everyone's just freewheeling.
Yeah. And you know, here's a dynamic that I've just grown to really love too, is that you get to re-experience your kids in an even sweeter way, because they just want their kids to lap you up.
Yeah.
My daughter told me, Mom, my kids, there's nothing that gives me greater joy to know my kids adore you. They adore you and Dad, Grandpa. Yeah. So it's that's a great joy.
We love that they love it too. It makes us happy that they want their kids to be with us.
That's awesome. Hey, you wrote 2 books. Tell us about
together.
Together.
Yeah, she's written several by herself, which we had two, which was the one other challenge to our marriage.
Yes, that was
writing books.
People together. Say you shouldn't remodel a house together, but I'm going to say co-writing a book was right up there. Mainly because it does show your difference in a style of approach to a project. And the first one we wrote, we had this idea, like, why are couples devotionals so boring and so unsexy? We were like, how come devotion time equals yawner, you know, for most people? It's, you know, you can do them separately, but when you try to do them together.
And especially, you know, you have the guy's devotion on his side of the bed, and the
woman's
devotion on her side, but never the thing shall meet.
So we decided to do one about intimacy, because we thought if a guy thought at the end of devotion time there was a chance of sexy time, then it would, he would really get into devotion time. That would be
it'd be high on his priority list now.
So we did Songs in the Key of Solomon, In the Word and in the Mood, about intimacy, about spiritual, relational, emotional, physical intimacy.
So trying to cover the bases for everyone, a little something for everybody.
We had a definite grid. And so, even though it took a little bit, we got that one done. And then the company wanted a follow-up. So it wasn't the first one that was the problem. The first one we were very...
The first one was more fun because we got to practice a lot.
We did. You know, like, what about...
like feed each other grapes in the tub. I mean, there you go. That's a good one.
So I was like, listen, you got stuck on that one for a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
so
you can. I tell people you can repeat. If you like one.
If you like one, just do
one
it
day, just no order.
Okay. So the second one we did was duets. Still in the Word, still in the Mood. And we thought it was a brilliant idea. We were like, how come there's
couples in the Bible?
No devotional book about couples in the Bible.
Yeah. Like,
oh, this is it. We've struck gold. Oh, here we go.
So we're going to take all the wonderful examples that are in the scripture and just build on them.
Yeah, it'll be great. Be easy. And then we figured out most of the people in the Bible as couples are just big fat failures.
There's more learning from mistakes than successes.
Yes.
In the arc of developing in it, we figured out it was almost like a reverse
encouragement
about your marriage. No matter how screwed up your marriage is, these people are more screwed up than you. Right. So
the beautiful thing, you know, again, talking about the reality of the scripture, like it wasn't trying to sugarcoat or make them seem, it laid out flaws and all, but then showed God's redemption and restoration. Yeah. And so,
Well, COVID is starting to lift. What lies in the future for you guys?
We would like to say we have lots of room for God to be creative since our calendars are.
But the fall is filling up, you know, tentatively, because people, you know, they want to commit. And the few events she has done recently, I mean, the people were just hungry.
I could have stood up and read a phone book and they would be like, isn't it great to be out? I don't know, hung on to the seat of God's pants for the ride, I guess is a good way of saying it. Yes. And he's never dropped us. We've had moments where the faith stretch is tougher and longer than it has been in others, but we haven't walked with him this long to be like, okay, well, I guess he's going to abandon us now, you know?
At this point again, you know, we used to try to get out in front of God, and then we'd have to back up sometimes that he'd have bigger and better. And we were like, well, we're going to go this way. And like, but if you just wait a moment. So, you know, the surprises through the years, we're like, what's the next
one? We are prepared to be surprised.
There you go. There you go.
Yes.
Well, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for being with us. And Peggy and I, we often talk about you guys in a good way, where we really, truly are so grateful to the Lord for bringing us together as couples and all the things we've been able to share through the decades. And we just love you guys so much.
So completely mutual. Yes. You guys are our heroes, but it's nice when your heroes are also your friends. And we thank God for your influence. You guys, I mean, people talk about, they use the word influencer about people on Instagram and stuff. And I'm like, it just seems so shallow when you know people who truly are influencers, and God has strategically positioned you guys for such a time as this. We love you. We pray for you. And we are so thankful that you even know our names. So,
Anita. Oh, man.
You guys are great.
Bless you. Bless you. And we just want to encourage faith in your heart for all God has, because I believe the best is yet to come.
You believe it.
The Lord has deposited such great things. And your voice, both of your voice and your ministry, is so needed. And we stand in anticipation. We can't wait to see what God's going to do.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to when we can actually be physically in the same zip code.
Yes.
Looking forward to that.
Yes. We love you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us for Life Off Screen with Dan and Peggy Ruppel. Life Off Screen is produced by Master Media International. Our technical director is Jason Rugg. Please subscribe to the Life Off Screen YouTube channel or subscribe to the Life Off Screen podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave your comments in the comment section. And to find out more about Master Media, go to mastermedia.com. Thanks again for joining us. Hope to see you next time.